Hello everyone, thanks for coming along to Apple Yard Leeds for this talk today. I'm Robert Cumming. I know a few of you in the audience have met with me before, but I'm a solicitor and a firm officer here. So I know a little bit about the directive, a little bit about the trademark regulation, but I'm sure you've already very thoroughly, you know it all inside out. It sounds like there are a lot of changes, which will probably take some time, I think, for the courts and for the registries to actually get to the bottom of and to work out what are those implications or implications of those changes for businesses. If you think back to the trademark directive that was introduced in 1989, that was the first harmonisation of trademark law across the European Union, and it's taken really 25 years or so since that was introduced before we really got some answers on all of the legal ins and outs on some of the recent decisions that have come out in relation to AdWords, for instance, back then, have really only been bottomed out in the last few years. So it might be that it will take another 25 years before we get all of the implications out of the new directive. So why are we bothering? Why do we need a new directive? Why do we need a new regulation? Well, the idea is that it's going to be modern, going to bring it everything up to date, going to change the law to reflect case law which has come out of the Court of Justice, the European Court, over the last few years. And then there's a further step towards alignment, harmonisation of trademark law in the national countries of the EU. The idea being, of course, it's easier, it's cheaper, it's clearer for everybody. And it's generally a bit tidy up. So it was looking a little bit dusty in places. There was bits of legislation in there that court cases had overruled and which had to be appealed. So this is really a good opportunity for everything just to get settled down again. There's a little quote there which was on the IPO website from just before this. From Baroness Neville Rolfe, UK Minister for IP, when she said, changes to the directive and the regulation should increase legal certainty and clarity for businesses looking to register and enforce their trademark rights in Europe. Convergence of trademark practices and processes throughout the EU will create a more robust and streamlined system fit for the digital age. So you can see precisely what they had in mind at the time. So two pieces of legislation. We have a directive which obviously applies and tells the national countries exactly what they need to implement in their national law. They can gold plate it in national law if they want. The UK, for instance, has extra requirements such as you need an intent to use. But the main requirements are set out in the directive and every country must comply with those. This directive actually replaces the directive which we refer to at the moment, 2008-95-EC. It sets out the mandatory requirements everybody must comply with. It came into force on the 12th of January 2016, but it doesn't need to be implemented by the member states until the 14th of January 2019. There's also some additional time allowed for countries who don't have administrative invalidity proceedings, such as France, to get their house in order by 2023. The regulation, separate document, separate piece of legislation, deals only with community trademark, which I'm now going to call the European Union trademark. That comes into force on the 23rd of March. I haven't been able to find a codified version anywhere, because what this regulation does is it amends Regulation 207 2009. So rather than replacing it wholesale, saying there you are, there's a fresh one just as this, it'll still be referring, I think, to Regulation 207 2009 as amended. But it's quite complicated to read between two of them side by side if you're actually reading through the old version and the new one, which says what changes or what words into its paragraph and so on. So hopefully there'll be a codified version which just shows what's in course going out to the commission at some point soon. If anybody knows where there's a codified version, then please feel free to share it with Vietnam and everybody else. So we're going to look first of all at the changes which have been introduced by the new directive, and then we'll have a look at the changes which have been introduced for the regulation. So first of all, the directive which looks at the national trademark laws and the community trademark. The first one that I found was quite interesting is that there's no graphical representation required. It simply states that a sign must be capable of distinguishing goods and services of one undertaking from another undertaking, and it must be clear and precise. But in the preamble, which is the actual bit of text which is very easy to read and tells you what it's supposed to do, the criteria for no graphical representation lists a fairly familiar list of clear, precise, self-contained, easily accessible, intelligible, durable, and objective, which you're all probably familiar with from the case of Siegman. I think the fact that there is no graphical representation required any longer is really a reflection of the changes that we've seen over the last few years in digital online technology. So before, you might have been able to have an audio or sound trademark, but you have to use musical notation. Well, is musical notation really the easiest way to display sound trademark? Well, why not just have the sound itself on a website somewhere and just upload the file? Probably easier to read, or easier to listen to rather, and easier to understand than musical notation. Something else which is quite interesting, and which actually goes against some of the case law that is currently in force, relates to goods in transit. So, hello, come on in. We're just working through the differences that have been introduced by the directive. And later on, going to look at the differences related to the regulation. So, we're only on the second point. So, one of the changes relates to goods in transit. Now, currently, if goods are brought into the European Union for onward export to somewhere outside the European Union, then the law says that they're never actually put on the market in the European Union. And if the goods are never put on the market in the European Union, then they're not used. And if they're not used, then they can't infringe. So it's very easy for infringer to use the European Union as somewhere to ship its goods through on the way to, for example, Brazil. So I believe it was the Court of Justice said, well, there's not a great deal we can do about that. If you want to change it, you need to legislate. So this is the legislation. It says now, if the owner has trademark rights in the country of export, the ultimate destination, then you can seize the goods inside the EU. It means, of course, unfortunately, you're going to have to buy more trademarks for our clients in those countries because they might be the export countries. What a shame. Sorry about that. Okay, so one of the other changes under the directive relates to oppositions. Now, oppositions in the UK are fairly robust, but they've not always been as robust in some of the other jurisdictions around the EU.
Destroyed your presentation.
Yeah.
I'm concerned it might start recording.
Yeah,
what's the exactly, yeah. That's why
anyway,
the IT guy
is. So, oppositions in the EU, they're fairly harmonised already, but just to make doubly sure, an opposition in the EU can now be based on reputation where it couldn't before. It can be based on reputation irrespective of whether the groups are similar or dissimilar. So, this goes back to the case of Davidoff, which is 16 years ago now. We're all fairly familiar with the fact that if there's a reputation, then you can challenge similar and dissimilar goods. But it was always left as a kind of legacy in the legislation, and so now finally being updated. One of the other bases on which you can now file opposition proceedings is a protected designation of origin or a geographical indication. So previously, I don't believe that you could file a petition based on the PDO or the GI. That means that when we are searching for, thanks for that, trademarks, then we also need to consider registering with the PDOs and the GI. That might not be something that clients would do as a matter of course. It's something that we should certainly think about as practitioners to make sure that the client is sure that when they are being given a clearance search, we have checked with the PDO and GI registers. But this raises the issue that if the client cannot identify whether there is a PDO and a GI, and therefore whether a mark is available for use, from doing a simple search on the IPO website or the open website. It's not making anything more certain, it's not making anything easier, it's not making anything clearer. It's precisely what the legislation was intended to do. So maybe it's an idea, it's just my speculation, but the UK IPO could include in its databases, PDO and GI databases, so that as well as all the trademarks, that's across it just seems logical, but maybe it's not. Sounds easy, so it probably isn't. Okay, so you've all heard of the case of IP Translator, I'm sure you have. It's a case that has rumbled on, and it was all very exciting. It changed the approach that the organ took to the interpretation of goods and services. And what it's done now through this legislation, it means that the approach on the literal meaning is harmonised in European Union law. So the legislation, the directive, requires IP lovers to work together, which I believe they're already doing with the TMPU project. But it also means that across the EU, wherever there was an approach which didn't follow the literal meaning, they now need to follow the literal meaning. This has implications for the EU trademarks system, i.e. the system that's run by Dorgan. We'll come on to that in a moment when we look at the changes introduced by the regulation. But it seems that finally, at last, we're all kind of to be working on the same literal meaning basis. So I said right at the start that one of the objectives was harmonisation across all of the EU member states on trademark law, trademark administration. And some of the countries listed here don't have opposition proceedings, others don't have reputation-based oppositions, others don't have administrative cancellation proceedings. So they've all got to get their house in order fairly shortly. something which I often come across when trying to assess a particular portfolio is when the non-use period begins for trademarks across the European Union. And unfortunately, in the old directive, there was no basis to say the non-use period shall always start at this point. So different countries have different starting points for the non-use period. For some, it might be the registration date. For others, it might be the date after the opposition closes, which is the post-registration. This tries to harmonise position. So in countries like Germany with post-registration opposition process, then the five-year period will always be calculated from the final dates of the potential proceedings. So we're getting there. I probably still ask the German just to double check. This is something that I found interesting in the preamble. I've not found it anywhere else in the legislation at all, but it seems to me a kind of backdoor entry of recognition that fair use might be a defence for artistic expression for use of a trademark. What it says is use of a trademark by a third party for the purpose of artistic expression should be considered as being fair as long as it is at the same time according to honest practices in industrial and commercial matters. And then it's not mentioned anywhere else in the directive, so maybe they put that in and thought, well, we'll just see how that see what happens. But it strikes me that, think of some of the cases of fair use, where the UK position has been different than the US position over the last few years. And it usually creates headlines because people can't understand that it's different from the US to the UK. But this maybe is one of those instances where it's kind of creeping into our shores. Good or bad, I don't know. Maybe it's a defence anyway, and you don't actually need this bit, but I just thought it was interesting. Kind of say what my personality is. So we've looked at the changes introduced by the directive. That's the law relating to national trademarks across the European Union, as well as the EU trademark system. The regulation relates only to the EU trademark. So this is what we would call community trademarks. There's a lot going on, there's a lot of changes, and I certainly can't cover them all today. So I've tried to cover the more interesting ones. If anybody else does have other interesting points, then please feel free to shout them out as well, and share that knowledge. I've broken them down here into names, fees, class-setting specifications, on earlier, filing and prosecution procedure, oppositions, and certification marks. First of all, what are we going to call these things? A community trademark will now become an EU trademark, the European Union trademark. OHIM will become the European Union Intellectual Property Office, EU Info, or EUI. I presume they've got consent from the EPO, because I think that's a similar service to patent registration services. EU IPO versus EPO, I hope they've got consent, but they might get the injunction. Fees, changing slightly, really to try and reflect the fact that it's a very cluttered register. Lots of people, if they think they're getting three classes for the price of one, you're buying an extra two classes in. Do you really use it in class 16 for packaging? Probably not, but put it in this field. Do you use it in class 9 for software? Probably not, but put it in. You might some software at some point. Well, that's regarded as putting up the register. So what OHIM has introduced, or what will happen, is the fee for one class will be reduced very slightly, and then the cost of two classes will be the same as three classes now. Renewal fees have gone down quite considerably, or a one-class application has gone down by about 30%. So good for clients who are one-class. last heading specifications. I said I'd come back to this. So, if you've got a client who has lots of trademarks registered for the class heading for musical instruments, for example, and it was filed prior to the IP translator decision of 22nd of June 2012, then there's a 6 month period from when the regulation comes into force, which during which time they file a declaration to say, I know we've got the class heading, but we definitely intended to cover everything in that class at the time. And if the client does that, then it will get the protection for everything that it then lists, which falls into that class heading at the time. If it's not done within 6 months, it then means the literal meaning. So if this procedure is not followed, then one could potentially lose some protection. So it's a kind of make a declaration or lose the rights. It does, of course, have to be the proprietor's intent to cover all of the goods and services of the class. I don't know how much investigation we go into whether that intent is genuine or not, or whether the matter is accepted. We also couldn't find any mechanism on the EU Trademarks Office website, or EU IPO website, to indicate how this declaration can be filed. So I'm hoping that some information will be distributed in the near future. But it's certainly something which, as a profession, I think that we ought to be raising awareness among our clients. The proviso, of course, there has to be a little written caption there, is that if a client or if a party expands its specification to include extra items, say music discounts, then it can't then use subsequent registration and the new items that are in there to attack the trademark that already exists. Does everybody follow that? So it's a way of sort of recognising that the marks which are already on the register before this declaration is a future have to be taken into account. You have to be sensitive to what's already out there. I think that might be very interesting, and there's probably going to be some case law from this particular issue. It seems, I can't imagine how we could get to a position where the literal meaning is exactly what it says for all marks in the future, unless we go through something difficult like this. But I anticipate that we will probably be some cases because somebody's going to be able to read at some point. So, oppositions to EU trademarks. If you designate the European Union as part of an international trademark application, registration, then what I always tell the Americans is you should definitely file it through us, because it will get you in 4 months. But if you file it as an EU designation, you have to wait 9, unfortunately. I'm sure we all know that. But unfortunately, that little advantage is going to be taken away from us, because the opposition period will now be basically 4 months. So that little time period where Bodin would normally examine any designation, you have to sit and wait for 8 months until the opposition period is gone. It could result in oppositions being filed before examination has been completed, but ultimately nothing to be a major issue. Put here that proof of use date or EU trademark is now the filing date rather than the publication date. So that brings it forward. So this is a slightly different slide on the screen to the one that you have in your papers, because I think this is the status quo only under the regulation, not under the directive. So it applies only to EU trademarks, not across the EU. So if you want to oppose an EU trademark, there's currently no provision to do so on the basis of copyright or design rights, which is a bit odd. You can do that in the UK, and there's provision for it in the directive, but it hasn't been followed through into the regulation. So maybe they just forgot to put it in there. What you can do is you can invalidate CTM, sorry, an EU trademark. You can invalidate an EU trademark based on copyright or based on design, but you can't oppose. So if you're watching service, see that there's something you want to oppose based on your copyright or a design, but you just wait, twiddle your thumbs until it's registered, and then you can invalidate it. And the reason for that is that the wording talks about you're entitled to, based on opposition, on a sign that is used in trade of more than mere local significance. That's not necessarily easy to do. Couple of cases there if you're interested in seeing how that has kind of panned out with Odin. But the Innocent Smoothie case was a few years ago. It wasn't the High Court case. It was a case that, because this Innocent Smoothie was basically protected by copyright, then there was no way an opposition could be filed, so the owner had to wait. Just illustrates the point. I don't know why it was missed. Maybe there's a good reason for it. Who knows? Maybe we'll have to wait for the sea to go all the way to the court just to get where it fits. Okay. So, some fairly formulaic points as well if you're filing EU trademarks. Filing and prosecution procedures changed slightly. Priority claims must be made at the time of application. I think pretty much we all do that most of the time anyway. You can opt in to the search report for what it's worth. Is it ever worth anything? Who knows? But there's no fee for it, unfortunately. And there's no delay between search report and publication. That was actually introduced in the earlier regulation. And what it meant was that as Odin got faster at examining, faster field of publications, that if they had to have this pregnant pause for a month where it didn't do anything because it wasn't allowed to because of the legislation, so Odin got too fast for its procedures and the legislation. It's going to be a lot faster. And then certification marks don't come up very often, of course, but we might see some EU-wide certification marks being filed. Very similar requirements to the UK, the new regulations, that file the regulations within a certain time, but there is going to be more legislation to deal with those issues. So just to kind of wrap up this part of the talk, before I hand over to Chris, the changes that we're seeing aren't wholesale, they kind of reflect the adaptations that we've already seen introduced through case law or through changes of practice technology. I think it'll be interesting to see disputes arising from expansion specifications given the new declarations that will be filed within the next 6 months. Will we see an implementation of a PDO or GI database? Who knows? The OHIM certainly likes to develop these kinds of projects, so maybe that's in the pipeline. And then the introduction and use of technology to cope with new types of non-graphically represented trademarks and maps. So I'll hand you over to Chris. Thanks very much for your time. There you go.
Okay. I feel like I'm slightly hijacking talk a little bit for trademark attorneys anyway. So I'm going to talk about copyright before at an EU level. Something which I think is quite interesting personally. And something which I think even trademark attorneys or IP solicitors we all sort of touch upon in our day-to-day work at any point. So what is sort of happening at EU level for copyright? Well, as most of us will know, it seems to be the sort of area of IP which has been left behind. We've got a lot of harmonisation with trademarks, designs, but not so much with copyright. And this has become particularly apparent now we have in the online world and trading on the internet. And the EU Commission has identified that this current law was the problem. So what have they done? So they, about 2 years ago, 2014, they set up a committee to look at the harmonisation of the EU and how it works in an online world. What they identified is that because it isn't harmonised, that we're losing up to about 450 billion euros worth of growth. So that's what they're anticipating. Quite ambitious, perhaps. But in essence, what the Commission wants is that ultimately we'll all have the same copyright laws, which inevitably is going to be difficult as countries, different member states have policies, culture, which dates back to their own copyright laws. So after some initial consultation over the period of 2014, a communication was released in December 2015, which touches upon what the Commission sees as the problems and the key areas. So, as I said, some of the problems at the moment that it doesn't reflect a digital single market, it doesn't reflect how we trade online, how people use the internet, how commerce is diversified. And that's principally because a lot of the laws that are based upon the national level are based upon directives, and a lot of those are optional. So what that means is that some member states might have implemented one directive, another might have not implemented it at all, and one might have implemented part of it, as Rob highlighted with the copyright issue. So that leads to a lot of fragmentation and a lot of uncertainty about what can be might work. So they're ultimately aiming to achieve a wider availability of creative content, adapting technologies, and create this all-encompassing, harmonised world that we should live in. So the EU Commission identified a few areas which they think are the most important at present. So after they did their consultation, these are the areas that, that they're working upon, which are the most concrete at the moment. We have content portability across borders, so that's to touch upon that. That's sort of using online service providers, internet streaming services, and whilst you're abroad. Harmonisation of copyright exceptions, inequality of rights holders, digital market, and enforcement. So, firstly, content portability. This is where there's been the most sort of advancement at the Commission level to date, where they've done the most work. So essentially what they've identified is that a user in a home member state might sign up to a service, streaming service, whether it be ITV Hub or Netflix. But the problem is that they'll go abroad on holiday, maybe a short period of work, and can't access that streaming service. A couple of examples that the Commission actually gave in the report is Netflix. So if you sign up in the Netherlands for Netflix, you can't access it in Germany. If you try to access it in Poland, you can't because they don't have Netflix in Poland. And also Now TV. So if you've signed up to Now TV in the UK, you can't access that anywhere else in Europe, which they perceive as a big problem. If you pay for or subscribe to a service over here, why shouldn't you be able to access it when you're on holiday? So what they've shown to me in the consultation is that people want to do this. And what it's leading to is a lot of people choosing to use VPNs or the virtual private network to access that material. And that's actually unlawful. So that then leads to piracy and making it okay. One of the reasons perhaps why this has happened is that I suppose rights holders are wanting to take some control over how the material is used. And I think if you're a rights holder, ideally you'd want to all split up into 28 different member states and you can control every bit of it. That can probably make it a lot more profitable than as a rights holder. But that's against what the EU wants to try and do, especially in the case of single market, freedom of movement and trade goes contrary to that. So, as opposed to everything else we're going to discuss, the Commission have already drafted a proposed regulation. Different to a directive is that the regulation will be enforceable straight away. And what the Commission wanted, they want this to be enforced by 2017, which is the same time that roaming charges will be abolished. So, roaming charges abolished, new mobile phones access everything you have subscribed to in the country, which will be fantastic. So, what does the draft regulation say? It says that the provider of an online content service shall enable a subscriber who is temporarily present in a member state to access and use the online content service. A couple of things that come to my mind when I read this is, firstly, what is a subscriber? And that's quite clear when you have signed up, you put in your username, put in your password, and you subscribe and maybe pay. But where it's less clear is if you, for example, are using iPlayer, which you have access to as a taxpayer. So your license fee will pay for your access to iPlayer. Are you a subscriber to that service then? Does that mean that iPlayer will have to fall within this regulation? I have to make sure that every person who is a licensed player has access abroad to iPlayer. It's not exactly clear to me yet. Temporarily present. There's no time scale on that at the moment either. So it's just temporary. How long that is, it's not exactly clear. Could be a few weeks, could be months. So I think we'll see a lot of developments over the stage this year, but it will move quite quickly if they're aiming to have a regulation enforced by 2017. The Commission also identified that exceptions to copyright infringement are a big issue across the EU. Again, because directives are perhaps optional in a lot of cases are not defined in very much detail. The best example of this is the panorama exception, which allows you to take photographs of buildings and sculptures. That's really disparate across the EU. So in the UK, this is completely exempted, so you're fine, you can take pictures of buildings, you can take pictures of sculptures, but in Italy, the exemption doesn't apply at all. And in Poland, for example, you can take a photo of sculptures, but you can't take a photo of a building. So very different across the EU member states. It's certainly something that needs to be harmonised. And I know as well, I'm on the copyright committee, this has come up as a big issue when you're talking to people in different member states. They really don't know what to do in terms of advising their clients and lots of other member state countries. Disability exceptions also differ across the member states, particularly important as far as the blind person is concerned. And as we'll see here, the EU Commission has identified the Marrakesh Treaty, which is aiming to improve that. The EU have already signed up to it, but are looking to ratify it. As of this month, there is a small block by about seven member states, so that's struggling to get through at the moment. Hopefully, it will. Text and data mining. So text and data mining is where researchers, most commonly in non-commercial practices, universities, will look at a large amount of data and try and analyse a pattern. The EU Commission has said that at the moment, this is applied only to non-commercial practices, that could be detrimental to EU's growth, business growth. So potentially we can see some collaborations and harmonisation of that law. Private, public collaboration. And then we've also got sort of exceptions to on-screen use that find it into physical terminals. You said that isn't right in today's age. You should be able to access it from online to access that library work. So we've got proposals, and I think we'll see some legislative changes sort of early this year. So again, going to move quite quickly. Fair remuneration of rights holders online. Now, it isn't specifically mentioned in the communication, but I think this stems a lot from streaming services like Spotify. I've been to a number of seminars. Spotify has always come up as problematic in this area. They're quite failing to properly remunerate the rights holders. A lot of rights holders, perhaps new onto the market, startup businesses, they can't negotiate license terms that were not that very good. And only recently this year, Adele objected to actually allowing her music on Spotify because of that very fact. So the commission wants to make it a much fairer place as well for rights holders to have their music or film, whatever it may be, disseminated online. We've also got uncertainties about what communications public is. It's derived much from linking, precision, only in the last couple of years, what and when is linking a copyright infringement. So that needs to be, again, harmonised. And as we'll see, I think it's been noticeable over the years, more and more service providers, online service providers, are taking advantage of the e-commerce directive, which allows them to act as a passive role and mere conduit. When the e-commerce directive was initially drafted, it was very in the early stages of the internet, applied more to perhaps ISPs, we did have a very passive role, but more and more service providers are going to be taking advantage of it. You see it Google, eBay, for example. I think what the e-commerce wants to do is control it. So again, we'll see some more proposals over the course of this year. And lastly, we've got enforcement. So although many of us might think that piracy is not as complex as it used to be, it's still a big problem. And the consultation found that around 22% of Europeans think it's okay to still download illegal material online. They still have somewhere to go. And what the commission wants to do is try and make it easier, especially for the smaller rights holders, to prevent that material from being illegally downloaded. So they're going to look at new enforcement procedures. One of those is a follow the money approach. So what they also want to see is more involvement in intermediary services. They want to see easier access, finding out how you can follow the money, how you can obtain damages, how you can identify who the infringers are. So hopefully we'll see some legal framework by the end of this year, which discusses identifying infringers, cross-border relief, how to pay their damages. And also we've got the takedown and stay-down principles. The commission are concerned about is that often when you file a takedown, it's quite slow. So if it's a legitimate takedown, it can take a long time. If it's not a legitimate takedown, so the person is using that copyright material legitimately, it can sometimes be taken down quite quickly. So again, it's a bit of a problem altogether. So to conclude, there's obviously clear need for harmonisation across EU member states. But I think the problem is that needs to be balanced. It needs to be balanced with the rights holders, it needs to be balanced with the providers, but also needs to take into account the political and cultural differences across the EU. So let's watch the space to see what happens in 2016. I think there will be lots of changes. I think it's quite an exciting area that we're to see that copyright is eventually maybe catching up with the other IP rights. So thank you very much. The register's outside. I think we've got lots of time now for food. So there's wine and drinks outside. Please feel free to help yourselves. And any questions?
Any questions, observations? You all know it perfectly. I'm sure. Good. I'm sure it'll be a learning curve for everybody, the introductions of the trademark changes. Certainly something I'll be looking very carefully next time. As a client, just to make sure that everything is exactly as I think it is. But hopefully there won't be too many pitfalls in there. It's just a case of reading and checking everything carefully.
I
it's interesting to hear about the copyright reforms. Like you say, Chris, I think it's it is lagging behind.
Yeah.
I think the trademarks have been harmonised for about 25 years, quarter of a century. Copyright seems to be one of those cases where who knows, is it fair, is it not, is it allowed, is it an exception? And then if you apply the European principle, it seems to be a bit of a mess, to be honest. So please help us eat the food, help us drink the wine. It's been great to see you. Thank you very much. And please feel free to send any feedback either to us or to Ipmar. Thank you. Thank you.